Hello, this is Mike Orshan.
Today we have William Arocha from the Monterey Institute of International Policy in California. And William, can you say hello and introduce yourself?
I'm a professor at the Monterey Institute of International Studies, which is in Monterey, California. For the Mexican government during the NAFTA negotiations, I was the chief of advisors to who used to be the deputy secretary for budget and planning of the Secretariat of Commerce and Development in Mexico. I resigned from that post. After that, I worked at the Canadian Embassy in Mexico City as their political analyst. When I was in Canada, I had to work as an assistant panelist to NAFTA's Chapter 19. It's the chapter that is dedicated to resolving disputes regarding anti-dumping and countervailing measures.
You were fortunate enough to work at putting the NAFTA agreements together, and at some point in it, you decided to resign from that. Could you give a little explanation of why someone might do that?
My resignation was really very much based on principles. I was always very concerned, particularly with the more vulnerable sectors of Mexico, one of them being, of course, the agricultural sector. But added to the agricultural sector, I also want to mention that I have always been very concerned, and I even worked in my PhD thesis regarding this, of the 11 million indigenous peoples that live in Mexico. These peoples were absolutely marginalized during the negotiations. Not just the agricultural sector was compromised in the negotiations, but the indigenous people were marginalized. When we talk about indigenous people, we're talking about nations within the state that have their own language, customs, uses of the land, understandings of law.
And that's about 15% of the people in all of Mexico, I think.
Exactly. One of the concerns of the indigenous people, as well as the small and medium-sized farmers in Mexico, was that the reforms that were carried out by, at that time, President Salinas de Gortari, and we're talking particularly of the reforms carried out in 1991, where Article 27 of the Constitution made it legal to sell ejido or communal land. And that allowed, of course, peasants to, for example, put up their land as collateral for loan, or to rent their land, or to sell out their land. And as you can imagine, most Mexican peasants have very small holdings, and the farmers therefore have to supplement their incomes by working either for remaining landlords in Mexico, new large agro-industrial businesses, or traveling to the United States. The problem is that for the indigenous people, and particularly for the indigenous people, the option of traveling to the United States is really the last recourse, because when they can alienate their land, when they can rent their land, sell their land, the problem with them, without the state guaranteeing the land, is that they lose the reason of being as people. So that was one of the reasons why we saw something that all along some of us, even in the Secretary of Commerce, knew was going to happen.
There's a reason they allowed distribution of land or to change those rules. What was that reason?
It's clear that the Mexican agricultural sector has been undercapitalized for many years. There hasn't been the right policies to produce, to create a good balance between production for export, so also production for the domestic market, the production that sustains the people. So that's been always a problem. There's been an undercapitalization of the land in Mexico. The other reason was that during the negotiations, there was the most difficult point of contingency between the United States and Mexico was oil. If there's one thing that the Mexican government could not give up was oil, the privatization of Pemex, and particularly privatization towards foreign capital. So they had, and one of the sectors that was always seen because of its undercapitalization as dispensable to trigger Mexico towards the industrialization sectors or the manufacturing sectors was the agricultural sector. So that's the one that ended up being sacrificed during the NAFTA negotiations. But that's the most volatile one, because that's where you have the most vulnerable population.
What do you mean sacrifice?
When you take away the guarantee of the land by the state, particularly for the indigenous peoples, you are basically making these nations very vulnerable, because they obviously cannot, because of the undercapitalization of the land, they cannot gain their land. Once the state stopped guaranteeing the tenure of the land, the state also started adjusting their policies in support of the land. So they became very vulnerable towards the imports, for example, of agricultural products from the United States, of course, mainly the United States. And mainly a key product in Mexico, which is corn. And for the indigenous people in Mexico, corn is not just a food staple. It is also a product that is part of the imaginary of what constitutes their nation.
During the NAFTA agreements, the Mexican held the high ground on controlling oil, but they gave up concessions on agriculture. And then, because of that, the United States was able to import corn, the basic lifeblood of Mexican agriculture, plus maybe apples and other things, at a price cheaper than the Mexicans themselves could actually make it. You know, the United States has more tractors, and they have economies of scales and all sorts of things. And is that the scenario?
Yeah, I mean, you know, by one estimate, for example, U.S. corn was sold in Mexico from 1999 to 2001 at prices about 30% or more below the cost of production, okay? Now, let me take you, therefore, to something that, of course, the indigenous peoples in Mexico and the small and medium-sized farmers in Mexico cannot deal with, and those are the agricultural subsidies. The U.S. agricultural subsidies are in the order of around $18 to $20 billion per year, okay, dollars per year. And a lot of these subsidies go for production of corn, of soybean, of sorghum, and other highly competitive crops. In Mexico, okay, so these subsidies are in the order of $1 billion per year, which are high, but how can you compare that with $18 to $20 billion per year? So what we're seeing here is, beyond asymmetries, we are seeing something that is really called dumping.
Now, land is going away. The price of their goods are going down. Their Mexican exports must be going down because the U.S. exports are going up. Is this the reason for the uprisings? I mean, I think that was always a question mark on everybody's mind.
The point here is that when we talk about agricultural trade, and particularly liberalization linked to NAFTA, it is the single most significant factor in the loss of agricultural jobs in Mexico. Okay, that's the point. There's been a loss of about 1.6 million jobs in the agricultural sector in Mexico. That's huge, okay? So basically, you know, we're talking that employment sector was, in the 1990s, from the 1980s to 1990s, it employed 8.1 million people. After NAFTA, we started seeing a downtrend with about 6.8 million employed in 2002. And this trend has continued all the way to 2007, where now we see, you know, about 5.1 million in the agriculture sector. Now, this is not necessarily bad in economic terms, because, of course, you would think that these jobs will go towards the manufacturing sector. The problem is that in Mexico, we have very limited development of what we call forward and backward manufacturing linkages. Okay, that would, of course, multiply job creation. We don't have this in Mexico. So what we see is an agriculture sector where the job losses do not end up in a manufacturing sector that has been developed through very strong economies of scale, if I may say. So these people have three choices, Michael. They either go to the agriculture sector in the United States, go to, if they have a network, to the assembly line system, which, by the way, is mainly woman-based, or they end up in the urban sprawls of Mexico City, Guadalajara, Puebla, and now some northern cities.
This is part one of a two-part interview. www.marsound.com. Thank you, and listen to part two.